Are you saying just about everyone could possibly have a seizure at some point?
I know this is a scary answer, but 1 in 10 people will have a seizure in their lifetime. 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy in their lifetimes, which is, as you can see, it's only about a third. There's so many different causes, so many things that can happen, from things that you do all the way to things you have no control over.
Dr. Elgovish, so fun to have you. You know, we've been friends for years and years and years. So I'm super excited to sit down and talk to you about a very important discussion, and probably what a lot of people are tuning into, maybe their patients. But let's first, you know, talk about who you are. Just give a little introductory on who you are.
Well, so who I am. I'm an epileptologist. So yeah. An epileptologist is a neurologist who's specialty trained in epilepsy and seizure disorders. And so that's what I've done my entire career. So I sometimes jokingly tell my patients that I know a lot about seizures, but I don't know much else.
Right.
So that's my background. In terms of training, I started in electrical engineering at Johns Hopkins, and eventually did what's called an MD PhD program, or medical scientist training program, which was moved to biomedical engineering, specifically imaging in epilepsy. And then, of course, neurology residency, epilepsy, and clinical neurophysiology subspecialty training. So that's where I ended up doing what I do now, which is clinical epilepsy, and did do research for some time and not currently doing that.
Yeah, and you and I actually met in Denver, Colorado, which is where we're at now. Yeah, so if you have tuned into the podcast, you're seeing a little bit different background. So I came to see Dr. Elgovish in Denver, and we worked, I don't know, 10 years ago, and it was super fun, you know, getting to know you and just blown away with your expertise. And that's why I'm super excited.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's get down into, you know, what people are listening, tuning in for. Is today we're going to talk about an important topic, which is like a first seizure versus a second seizure and so on and so forth. What I know about seizures is that the first one doesn't necessarily classify you as epileptic. And I don't know, and we'll dive into what it does mean whenever you become epileptic. So people might be watching who are, they've had their first seizure, they're trying to figure out what's going on, or maybe they're diagnosed with epilepsy. So I really want to touch on that, stay in that kind of zone.
Sure.
So let's walk through the typical experience of someone who has a first-time seizure and they're tuning in. What would you say to that patient?
Right. So some things to start with is, I guess, what is a seizure? When someone says you've had a seizure, what does that mean? There are a lot of things that look like seizures and aren't, and that's a big part of my job, is to sort that out. But most people are not going to see someone like me, probably ever.
Yeah.
And certainly unless they end up in pretty bad shape and they need a subspecialist. So most people are going to end up in the ER. And what typically happens is that you have an event that can be pretty scary. And I know from experience, neurological symptoms can be frightening. And when that happens, you're gonna end up in the ER because you're going to be concerned about what might be going on. Even a really bad migraine can sometimes make you worry. So you go to the ER and they help you sort out what's going on. Now that first seizure can be anything from mild and just concerning to you, all the way to something very dramatic like a convulsion. And that's typically what they are, is much more dramatic. To ambulances call 911, right? They take you to the hospital. You go to the ER and they evaluate you. So that that's typically what's going to happen with that first seizure. So what is a seizure? So a seizure is any kind of transient symptoms, or what are called signs, which are things that other people can see, that you know, are occurring because of excessive or synchronous neuronal activity in the brain. And when that happens, that can cause this sort of sudden, but usually short-lived, changes in anything from movement to awareness. And when that happens, that's a seizure. So that's not the same thing as epilepsy. And like you said, you know, we can certainly get into that. That's not the same thing. A single seizure is really a symptom. A seizure is a symptom, not a disease.
Now, so, let's talk about real quick what causes seizures. Like what can be something that throws someone into a seizure fit?
Right. So again, because it's a symptom, there are so many possible causes of what can do that. And some of those, we really like to break it down, just start with provoked and unprovoked. And you'll see in a moment, that's how we end up with that diagnosis of epilepsy or not. So a provoked seizure, an example is, let's say alcohol withdrawal. If you drink a lot and then you don't, you're probably going to have a seizure, but that's not epilepsy. That's a provoked event. Similarly, there can be certain drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine that can cause seizures. Those are provoked. An example can also be that if you fall down, you hit your head, you're in a car accident, you have a trauma, you have a bleed, a hemorrhage. That is something that can cause seizures. So that's a provoked cause. Now, unprovoked means you end up in the ER and they're evaluating you and nobody has any idea why it happened. You know, you're not using drugs. You're not drinking a lot. You didn't just hit your head. So why is that happening? And that those causes are different. So those are predispositions to have seizures and you just had your first. So that can be, for example, you have a family history of it. It's genetic. So that's one cause. Another is that maybe in the past something happened. You had an infection like meningitis, or maybe you did hit your head at some point in the past and nothing happened then, but now you've developed this predisposition to have seizures. So those would be some of the causes.
Yeah. And so when you say provoked, going back to that, are you saying just about everyone could possibly have a seizure at some point given the right circumstances, or if something happened, an injury or something like that?
Wow. I know this is a scary answer, but 1 in 10 people will have a seizure in their lifetime.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, a lot of people can end up with a seizure. And that is very different from, again, from epilepsy, which we'll talk about. But 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy in their lifetimes, which is, as you can see, it's only about a third. The answer is yeah. And you can see that there's so many different causes, so many things that can happen, from things that you do all the way to things you have no control over.
Yeah. One in 10 people. So what do these seizures look like? I mean, I always talk about the flopping around and you know, of course, the stereotypical movie seizure.
Yeah.
Now, and we can get into that. That's generalized tonic-clonic. And it does, you know, in the movies, it doesn't look like that. But they are very obvious. They fall to the ground, lose consciousness, maybe have some jerky movements. Yeah. But is that what when you say 1 in 10, is that what patients are these people experiencing seizures? Is that the kind of seizures they're having, or what does that look like?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because what you see in the movies is not what seizures look like. They're never going to have on TV or a movie a real seizure. One reason is, well, how are you going to get that, right? That's going to be, that's dangerous. The next is that, we're talking about convulsions, of course, but the next is that, I think it's a terrible idea to have a seizure on television or movies, because they're so scary. They're really frightening to see, and I think that's not something people want to see. So that's one. I think what some people will do is they'll go to YouTube. They'll go see videos there, and I can tell you, because I've done it. I've shown patients that or suggested videos that they may look at, that many of the seizures that people post, say on YouTube or on the internet, also aren't seizures. They're misidentified by that person who put the video up as a seizure. So you can very easily be misled into thinking that, oh, I know what a seizure looks like. Well, you may not. It may be that what you're seeing is not. But the more kind of general answer to your question is that a seizure can look like almost anything. There are many, many ways that it can look. And it can be anything from something really, really subtle, like, that's it.
Yeah.
That could be a seizure. Just stop for a moment, blink for a second. That can be a seizure. Or it can be a minute or two where someone may chew and just stare or may have movements of their arms that are unusual, all the way to they can have very brief jerks, But sure, the most dramatic is going to be that convulsion, which, as you said, we call generalized tonic-clonic seizures. Tonic is that the stiffening phase of it, and clonic is the jerking phase. And that used to be called grand mal, which is at least physicians don't typically use that term anymore. Yeah. But again, you can have a funny sensation. You can have a movement, which can be jerking of a part or all of the body. It can be visual, where they may see something. They may smell something. So just about anything you can imagine.
Yeah. Okay. So for the people who are listening and they have decided to go to the ER because of something they experienced that they're in question about, they go to the ER. How does the ER then handle the first time seizure patient, like a patient who's had a seizure for the first time?
Well, so I'll start by saying I'm not an ER doctor,
right.
But I'll do my best to outline what happens in the ER, what someone can expect in again, sort of general outline. The first thing is that they have to stabilize the patient. They have to make sure that they're okay, that they're breathing, right, that their circulation's okay. These are all really important things that they're going to do first. And that's because a seizure can be dangerous. So in a number of ways, and so they want to immediately stabilize. Once they've gotten somebody stable, there are going to be some things that they initially do. They're going to examine and make sure that the patient is not still having a seizure. Mm-hmm. And that may be obvious. You know, let's say you have a convulsion, someone is shaking, and then it stops. Right? And they do, seizures tend to end within 2 to 3 minutes. And so you might think, well, they're all going to end within 2 to 3 minutes. What can happen is that the person doesn't quite come back to their baseline. They don't quite recover to their normal thinking. And when that happens, they may still be having seizures and you just can't see it, or it may be subtle, or it may be that all that you're left with is confusion. Then again, you may have that confusion because you had a seizure, and it may be that you're not having a seizure anymore. So that's why that second part after stabilization is so important, because to continue to have seizures, that's called status epilepticus, and that's even more dangerous than a single seizure. And you can have some more permanent damage from that. So it's very important to identify. And that's one of the first things they're going to do. So there's a couple different ways they can do that. They can get an EEG, and if they're really concerned that the patient is in status epilepticus, they probably will just go ahead and admit to the hospital. Hopefully they have EEG so they can hook up the patient and identify if they're still having a seizure. And if they are, they're going to need to treat that, admit them, and take care of it. Now,
How fast does an EEG need to be administered to the patient before you can, you know, stabilize or decide whether the patient could go up to the hospital room or be discharged?
Like, so this is an assessment that they're going to do right away, which is, do I need to be concerned, or is this somebody that's recovering? A lot of the time, if not all the time, that seizure is going to happen in the field. It's going to happen at home. It's going to happen out somewhere. The ambulance is going to do that. That EMS is going to do that initial stabilization before someone gets to the ER. So they're not typically doing EEGs in the ER. That's not commonly done, and they're not usually needed. They're going to go ahead and say, please see a neurologist after we discharge you as soon as possible. They can do some more of this testing. But if the person is not waking up, not responding, not recovering, not returning to their baseline, you're going to need to hopefully admit them and get that EEG to know if they're not getting better. A couple other things they're going to do in the ER, they're going to do some testing there for sure. One is they want to understand why did this happen? And that's a part of that is identifying the history. They're going to talk to any witnesses or family that's there and understand, well, have they had this before, right? Or is this truly, like you said, is this the first one? So they need to evaluate that. Do they have a history of a brain tumor? Well, then it's less of a surprise that they had a seizure. Are they coming here from a car accident where they hit their head? And maybe we need to make sure that there's no bleeding in their head. They had hit their head. So that's where they may do something like a CAT scan, a head CT, to see if that could be going on. But there's also blood work too. They're going to check for low glucose, which can cause seizures, low sugar. They're going to check electrolytes because some of those can be out of whack and cause seizures. An interesting thing they may check, but I don't see this a lot, is serum lactate. And what that is that for a couple hours after a big seizure, there's evidence in the blood that someone shook all over from the muscle. And that's really helpful to understand if that is what happened, because the ER doctor, they don't see the seizure, right? Mm-hmm. It happened somewhere at home or wherever. So that's one of the tests they may do. They're going to do some imaging, but something like a brain MRI, they may recommend that you follow up with a neurologist.
Okay, so when a patient actually is referred to a neurologist after they have their first seizure, what does that follow-up actually look like? What does a neurologist start to do with that patient?
When someone is seeing a neurologist for the first time, remember that the ER is really just stabilizing the patient, making sure they're okay to go home. They may admit them, and if there's looks like they're that they need to be, it's a worse situation. But typically, whether they're admitted or seen in just in the ER, they're going to tell somebody to go see a neurologist to either for their primary care to refer, they're going to recommend that they find a neurologist. When the patient sees that neurologist, the neurologist's job is to, if it's, we're assuming here a first-time seizure, right, is to identify causes, to understand whether it truly is the first, and really to assess risk, so risk of recurrence. So why is that so critical is that if it truly is just one seizure, that 1 in 10 that anyone can have in their lifetime or 1 in 10 people can have in their lifetime, you may not need a medicine. You may not need more follow-up. You may not need to keep seeing a neurologist.
Even if it was unprovoked.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It may never happen again. You can have an unprovoked seizure once in your life. So the neurologist has to now assess, which is something the ER is not going to do typically. What is, they're going to do a little bit of it, but a neurologist is going to assess what that long-term risk is. So some of the ways to do that are, let's start with history and risk factors. So what actually happened? What kind of seizure was it? There's going to be certain kinds of seizures that you're going to have again. You just know from the type of seizure that it is. Having a convulsion, for example, which is what we call nonspecific, there's so many causes, that may truly only happen once in your life. So the neurologist is going to talk to you about that. So the next thing is, is there anything in that background, that medical background, that suggests that you're at risk of having another one? For example, have you hit your head before? Do you have you had an infection like meningitis? Did you have really high fevers with seizures, febrile seizures as a baby? Any complications when you were born? These are all risk factors for developing epilepsy. And if you have just one seizure and you had meningitis as an infant, they're going to go ahead and say, we should probably treat this because it's probably going to happen again. Whereas if there's just nothing in the history, your normal neurological exam, which are going to examine you, they do some basic testing and it's all normal, it's a very different long-term risk.
Now, when a patient comes in, they're always doing MRIs or EEGs. Why are they doing that? What are they looking for? What's the differences between the EEG and the MRI? And you as an epileptologist, what are you trying to figure out by looking at these tests?
So brain imaging like MRI or EEG are usually done by neurologists before a patient ever sees me. At least the most basic of EEG, which is called routine EEG, takes about 30 minutes or so, 45 minutes in the office, and brain imaging like MRI. So here's how they're different. An MRI is taking pictures of your brain anatomy. It basically scans you in this long tube and tries to get an idea of, are there any structural changes or differences with you, something you may have been born with or something that may have happened later? Like, yeah, I hate to say it, but something like a brain tumor, which is not common, but it is a cause of seizures. So they're looking for all these things. They're trying to understand, again, do you have a risk of having more seizures? EEG is different.
How do they do that, though? How do they actually quantify a risk of having more seizures?
Yeah. So if your MRI comes back and the anatomy all looks normal and there's nothing unusual there, there's no structural changes, your risk of having more seizures is much lower. Maybe it's closer to 30% or so. That is, of having a second seizure. On the other hand, if you get an MRI and that brain MRI shows that you have a lesion, as we call it, something that suggests risk of seizures, that risk goes up to like 80% of having a second seizure. So that's to quantify what that risk is. EEG is similar. So EEG is really just measuring or looking at brain waves. And they put these electrodes over your entire head so that they can evaluate those brain waves from different parts of your brain. And when you look at that, you're looking for evidence that you have abnormal electrical activity that suggests risk. If your EEG comes back normal, your risk of having a second seizure is not zero. It's still around 30% or so. Maybe we'll say one out of three people are going to have that second seizure within 2 years. So this is.
Yeah. And why is that? Sorry to interrupt. Why is that? Is it because the brain that is susceptible to having seizures looks just like the brain that's not susceptible to having seizures?
So essentially, just because any test is normal doesn't mean you're normal.
Right.
It means you didn't catch whatever that abnormality is.
Yeah.
What's different about EEG is that it really is just catching in that moment, down to the millisecond, your brain activity. And it's very possible that 45 minutes after your EEG is over, that's when that abnormality occurs. It may not be all the time, which is why epileptologists like myself actually do longer EEGs. We may do days of EEG monitoring or even bring someone in the hospital and do even longer monitoring. So that is to catch things that don't get caught in that initial EEG. But we can't put everyone in the hospital for a week and look at their brain waves. So we do those shorter ones. So that risk of having a second seizure is, again, around 60-something percent if you have an abnormal EEG, but again, yeah, only about 30% if you have a normal EEG. But what if you have both? What if you have an abnormal MRI and an abnormal EEG? You're looking at 90%.
Right.
You're probably going to have another seizure. And that's where that neurologist, epileptologist, whoever is going to say, we really need to start a medication, even though you've only had one, and even though we don't know why it happened. There's no clear risk unless we see it again. If you see it on the EEG, you probably have epilepsy. But if the EEG and the MRI are both normal, then we say, you know what, you had one, we're not sure why, and maybe a medication is not absolutely necessary. And that's another conversation.
Is that the only indication why a patient would go on medication, or can you have something where it's normal MRI, but maybe abnormal EEG, and you want to see how a medication works just to make sure? Like, what is that? How do you do that?
Yeah. So other than the tests that a doctor does, there's other indicators of risk, right? So I mentioned earlier, if you have other past risk factors. So I went into that. But there's also other neurological or other disorders you may have that put you at risk. If we think of some neurological ones, we might say a past stroke or a brain tumor or a head injury, like a traumatic brain injury, multiple concussions. Even if the EEG and the MRI are normal, we're going to say, wow, you really have quite a bit of risk here. And that is a consideration for starting medication. But you're right. It sounds like you were hinting at, well, sometimes do you just start a medication? Is that the right thing to do, even when you don't have all these clear risks? There are situations where you start a medication and you try it. This isn't something you're planning to do for the rest of your life, but you're concerned. There's some reason for that concern, patient concern, doctor concern. And when that happens, you can take a medication. You try to pick something that's well tolerated, and you do that for a few years. And then if nothing happens for those few years, and you start to feel more confident that, sure, the medication may just be preventing it, but maybe you're okay, you may try a wean of that medication. And that's a risky thing to do, to try to come off.
What's the process of that?
So it depends on the medicine. It depends on how long you've been on it. It depends on all that other history we talked about having to do with risk.
Let's just say Keppra.
Yeah, so that's the most common. That's a commonly started medication in ERs. And I'll touch on that. Why is it that ERs are constantly starting everybody on that drug, which is the generic is levetiracetam? That medication, it can be started at an effective dose right away in the ER. They can tell you, go ahead, take this. It's going to work for you. It does not going to take 5 weeks to get to a good dose. Another reason is that it's well tolerated in most people. They tend to do well with it. And so it's easy for an ER physician or a neurologist or primary care to start that. It also is pretty effective for different types of seizures. So remember, whether it's the ER, primary care, or even first time you see a neurologist, they may not know exactly what you have. They're doing some initial testing. They're talking to you. So they just start something that's going to probably work. And that's why Keppra, another reason why Keppra is commonly used. So if someone is on a low dose of Keppra, that can be stopped pretty quickly. If they've been on it a short time, it's only been a week, to get to a reasonable dose and they're on a low dose, you can take a week to come off of it. If it's somebody that's going to be on Keppra for years and years that are a higher dose, you're going to take a few weeks to come off that. And there are seizure medications that you may take months to very slowly come off of.
Yeah. And kind of painting like an example, like a picture here. Let's say the patient goes to the ER. They put the sees a neurologist, prescribed anti-seizure medication. Is that when an epileptologist like yourself steps in? When do you come in? Because we talked about a neurologist versus an epileptologist. When does that? When does the epileptologist come in?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons why a neurologist or primary care or an ER would send somebody to see an epileptologist. And that the most common, most obvious is that the seizures aren't stopping. So someone, this is called, there's so many names for this, but intractable epilepsy, medical leave, refractory epilepsy, there's any number of names, medically resistant.
Drug resistant.
Drug resistant. There's so many names. And the bottom line is that someone has said that you have epilepsy. They may be right or wrong, but they've diagnosed you with that. They've started you on a medication. It didn't work. You keep having seizures. Maybe it's once a week. Maybe it's three times a week. Maybe it's every day. Maybe it's once a month, but it's still happening. So they try a second medicine. They either add it or they replace the first one, and it doesn't help. You keep having seizures. If that happens, that's a common reason to send to a subspecialist like myself, an epileptologist, to evaluate two things. One, is it really epilepsy? Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's been, there's been some confusion along the way with testing or with the diagnosis from history. And so that's, it's a second opinion you can think of it as, of is this truly epilepsy? Because maybe if it isn't, that's why it's not working, the medicine.
Right.
So there are a couple other reasons why someone would refer to an epileptologist. For example, if a woman is pregnant, that can be complicated, especially with certain medications, and the physician may want a specialist to work through that. What do you do when somebody is pregnant and has seizures and is on medication? So that's one that you would refer. Another is for more aggressive testing, like I mentioned earlier in the hospital, or longer EEG. Those are reasons you might refer. And then there's pre-surgical evaluations. So where if someone has had a lot of seizures, they don't seem to be responding, and there's a consideration for doing some kind of surgery, that may be when you need an epileptologist. And those are usually at specialty centers. They're called epilepsy centers. Many of them are universities, but they're also private ones. And that is an opportunity for that kind of evaluation.
Okay, so when a patient comes in, is the first seizure not epilepsy? Maybe explain a little bit about the difference between a first seizure and a second seizure and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So again, if 1 in 10 patients can have, or people can have, a seizure in their lifetime, and 1 in 26 can develop epilepsy in their lifetime, when does that first or second seizure, when do we call that epilepsy? So epilepsy means a predisposition or a higher likelihood of having recurrent seizures, not just one, not just maybe even two, but a recurrent seizures. And that can be sometimes unknown why. And that's something we call idiopathic. We don't understand why they keep happening. But in a lot of cases, we do. And that can be identified through imaging or through EEG abnormalities or through the history, like the type of seizures. Sometimes it's a syndrome, which is a collection of findings or types of seizures or history, family history. And then we say we understand what this is. It's a syndrome. So when someone has one seizure, that can be provoked or unprovoked and just be one event. If someone has two seizures and they're provoked, that still really isn't an epilepsy. That could be that they are having alcohol withdrawal seizures over and over again, or they're using drugs, or they've had other provoking factors that can do that, infections. That's not epilepsy. But if you have two or more unprovoked seizures that don't occur within 24 hours of each other, and they seem to keep happening, right? That's where we call it epilepsy.
So would you say that's the definition of epilepsy right there?
I think that's fair enough, which is two or more unprovoked epileptic seizures that didn't happen within 24 hours of each other. Yeah.
Yeah. You heard it from an epileptologist. You heard it first.
You could Google that too.
It's everywhere. All right. So that's the definition of epilepsy. And you had mentioned when people come to see you, maybe it's not epilepsy. Well, what else could it be? I mean, how do you differentiate epilepsy versus syncope versus panic attacks, stuff like that?
So some of those things, whether it's syncope or panic attacks, they can be really good mimics of epilepsy. Both because, so they can be mimics of each other. Either something like fainting, which is what syncope is, or a panic attack, can be misdiagnosed as a seizure. At the same time, epilepsy can also be misdiagnosed as panic attacks or as syncope. It really works both ways. And the reason is that there's an overlap of some of the symptoms of these things, right? So let's talk about, let's say, syncope first. Syncope is a sudden loss of consciousness. You fall down and you're not responsive. Well, a seizure can do that too. So how do you tell the difference? Similarly, a panic attack can have fear, sudden anxiety. It can have, your thoughts are running. A lot of these things can also be seen with seizures. You can have sudden anxiety with a seizure. And so how do you tell those things apart? So one is going to be past history of these types of episodes. Have they happened before? What are they like? How often do they happen? How long do they last? So a seizure, again, tends to be 2 to 3 minutes in most cases. Syncope is a sudden loss of consciousness. You fall to the ground and typically you're up pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. It isn't something where for 3 minutes you're not responding. That starts to make you suggest that something else is going on. Now, where things can become complicated are things like convulsive syncope. Convulsive syncope is where you fall down, you pass out, and then you shake. Well, how do you know that's not a seizure? So typically those are brief compared to brief shaking and brief event relative to a true convulsion. They have a different appearance to them. And where someone like me can identify is the things I mentioned together with videos, witness testimony. I ask patients to do, not just the patients, but witnesses, family members, friends, to do an impression of it for me. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if I can see that impression, that helps if there's no video. It is so scary when it occurs, a seizure, a lot of the time that people are not thinking. You'd think in this day and age, everyone's doing a selfie
right.
of the seizure, but they don't do that. They're freaking out. And when that happens, I don't get a video. And that's a good thing. I shouldn't be getting it. They should be taking care of their friend or loved one. But if sometimes I do. And when I can see the video, I can help identify.
Especially sometimes if this is something that the mom or dad or parent are really concerned about. They've noticed something about their child. You can get some videos from that.
I have. I have. And interestingly, and you'd think this, as crazy as this is, I've seen videos from retail stores like Walmart. I've seen videos from security cameras. I've even seen video of a seizure of someone who drives commercial vehicle where they're on video in the commercial vehicle. So I've seen a lot of these things.
So they have the event. They know they had it at Walmart. They know there's security.
They go ask for the footage.
Interesting.
And they get it to me and then I can see what happened. And so that's
like a detective.
You are
a detective.
I think physicians in general are detectives,
100%.
Right? And so how do I tell the difference between these things? Sometimes there's something visual to see. So a syncope, there is. With a panic attack, that's very subjective. Someone is experiencing something. So how do you tell the difference with that? I mentioned some of the ways, but there's of course testing, MRI, EEG. An EEG in someone with panic attacks is not going to show what we call epileptiform discharges that suggest they have epilepsy. You're not going to see that unless they have epilepsy.
Yeah. And that's a brainwave patterns on the EEG.
Yeah, that's a brainwave pattern on the EEG that suggests that risk of more seizures. Someone who has epilepsy, not all the time, but a lot of the time, you're going to see that abnormality, and that helps in that situation. Otherwise, it can be pretty tricky to tell the difference. And that, again, it comes from just experience of talking to a lot of people, hearing the history and the symptoms and what they felt, and then looking at testing.